Yeah, hi everyone. It's a pleasure, as always, to be in the PI, but virtually. I understand there is a World Cup game going on now, so I appreciate your dedication being in this room. Yes, so let me start with my general motivations with this this project. So I'm interested in understanding field theories that are strongly interacting. But maybe not infinitely strongly interacting, so that we don't necessarily know that they are dual to something like Einstein gravity. But in general, holography relates strongly interacting systems with gravity, and we know, for example, that if we have a finite temperature state in the system, it's going to be dual to line of temperature, to a black hole in the bulk. And a basic question one can ask is, okay, how do you think about the black hole geometry from the boundary perspective? There have been various answers to that question over the year, known as Bolic reconstruction, and I will propose a particular answer today that's based on a relatively straightforward way, I think, to see the geometry, not to reconstruct it, but to really see it, and in terms of simple measurements, which would be the four-point correlation functions. So the star of today would be correlation functions of 4 points in an arbitrary excited state, not the vacuum. What could be the vacuum? So that's the object of interest. We would see that this object, when the bulk matrix exists, it's actually very simply related to this object. It's a relatively simple exercise to work out the relation. But one appealing thing about this object is that it's always defined. So you can study this correlator even when there's no bulk metric, and we'll see in what sense the reconstruction fails. This sort of reconstruction, because we're working exactly in an excited state, is going to work exactly to our order in the expectation value of stress tensor, for example. So yeah, I'm making reference to a story that maybe you have not looked at. But for example, when you have if you start with some matter in the bulk, you could let me see if I can draw. Just a second. It doesn't look like I can draw. Can't annotate. Okay, I don't see the annotation here. Anyway, okay, and let me just say it in words. So if you have a massive object in the bulk, for example, the simplest thing that can happen is that you exchange one graviton with the boundary, and then you have a more complicated object, a heavier object in the bulk, it will exchange with two graviton and so on. So there's been progress thinking about the bulk geometry in terms of one graviton exchange, two graviton exchange, three graviton exchange, and then you would like to keep going, but in practice, it's very hard. So in this approach, we automatically get all orders. That's the appealing thing. We're really working with a finite perturbation from EDS. And the main other thing that would be important for me, I think it's important, is that we also want to resolve small-scale features in the bulk. So we don't just want to understand, roughly speaking, why we have a ADS-like geometry. We really want to understand why this local physics at sub-ADS scales. And you know, in some sense, that is really the for me at least personally, that's a situation in which ADS CFT is the most juice. The situation when, if you have local physics in the bulk, you can really say that ADS CFT is relating a field theory to a theory of gravity. But if you don't have a local physics in the bulk, then okay, it becomes a bit more a matter of definition, right? But I think everybody agrees with, if you have point particles that interact by a Newton potential, everybody agrees that there's gravity. So that's a sort of situation. And for me, it's really important to see this. You really have to probe distance scales that are shorter than ADS radius. That's what we'll be able to do with this correlator. And eventually, we'd like to do kind of bootstrap games and constrain these things, but that we're not going to get there today. Okay. So here's the rough plan. So yeah, I will explain now we can do interesting thing with 4 points. I should mention, so obviously humanity has studied four-point correlators for ages. Surprisingly, there are new unexplored corners. That's the main message you should take from this talk. There are interesting limits of four-point correlators that have not been studied yet, and I will connect those with the bulk construction. So that should be the most of the bulk of my talk. And then I will show pictures and movies of what this correlators look like. In what sense do they reconstruct excitations in the bulk? Okay. And we'll do it. I'll do it in the reverse order. Then it's all, this is based on a paper that was out a month ago or so with the same title of this talk. In the paper, I first do the correct calculation and then I do the cheap approximation, which is geometrical optics. Okay. In the talk, I will go the opposite order and just like do the naive thing and then explain the right way to do it. But that's the plan. And feel free to interrupt many times. Okay, so let me introduce the cast of characters. So we're gonna have a four-point correlator. So let me start with one point. Okay. So we start with some quantum state in the boundary field theory. It could be a density matrix, but it's more painful to write. So write it as a pure state. And we want to excite it. We do so by acting with some operator in which we inject a high frequency. Okay. So this is a very familiar construction. You take a state and you excite it by acting with some operator. Okay. And the wave packet will not be anything clever. It's just like a plain wave. So we have it's going to be important that we have a high frequency. And we put some envelope just so that we can say that we're doing some local excitation. So that's our wave packet. And the operator today would be simple things like the stress tensor or currents, or if you're lazy and don't want to work with Lorentz indices, just some scalar with a small scaling dimension. Doesn't have to be heavy. So that's our setup. So if we look at this thing, that should be some state, that's basically our original state with some O excitation on top of it. And you can ask a basic question, like how much energy is there in that new state? And these sort of questions are answered by, so we have to take the state, put it on the, basically square it to take an expectation value. So we get the three-point function. So this basic question, like what's the energy density in the state is answered by this three-point function. Right, there's no operator on the right O that creates the state, that creates the excitation. And then this kind of, yeah, we when you take the dagger of that state, we have an operator O on the left, which absorbs that excitation. In principle, you don't really need to have separate wave packets for the two O's. Just having a single integral over the difference is enough. So we would just simplify our life by having a single integral like this. That's just a technical point. A main thing about this correlator of OTU is that it's not in time order. Like if I were to put the O on the right of the T, I would like be creating the excitation, absorbing it, and then like basically measuring the energy of the original state, like not doing anything. The measurement is only interesting when the T is between the creation and the elation operator. Okay. There's a formal way of saying this, which is kind of sketch on this figure, is that you have to look on the Schwinger-Keldysh time fold. So the picture here. So this, I will not go into this, but there's a formalism basically to do this. So you have your ket, you have your bra roughly, and you have to evolve both of them and pair them after your measurement. And this kind of path integral contour can do that. So the standard technique to do this. And if you look at this contour, you might wonder why is there a singularity in the first place as the separation between these two guys go to zero. And an important point, which is discussed at length in the paper, is that there is a singularity, but it doesn't come from short distance effect. It comes from particle going all the way around the contour. So this O creates a fast particle, it moves in the future. And then we can think of it two ways. We can take a particle in a bra and evolve it and then pair them together, or we can take the original particle and propagate it backward in time on the second branch. And it's the same calculation. And they give you a picture like this on the right. So that's the picture we had before. Okay. So the particle and going back. And this particle source some gravity field that that's what we're measuring at a boundary. Okay. So if we do this experiment, well, if we measure this three-point function, it's being studied by new people, it's very similar to the conformal collider physics story in vacuum. So if the theory is holographic and this momentum p is time-like, what will happen is that the excitation here will follow a bulk geodesic, null geodesic in a bulk, and the orientation of the geodesic is controlled by the momentum. And basically, you make a null momentum by adding a radial momentum to the thing. So we create a high energy equation which follows a geodesic. And actually, you can control very well, I will discuss that more, but you can control very well the orientation of this geodesic. So you really get to tune where the particle go. And then you're measuring the energy density here from the gravity field induced by this particle. And what you see in this measurement is that you basically see an expanding shell of energy, typically. So actually the measurement is peaked around the null. This particular measurement here is peaked on the null cone. And we can say various things about this shell of energy, but a basic fact is that we've gone through a lot of effort to create a point particle in the bulk. And like this one point function of the energy doesn't really reveal that. So I'm saying it again. So we've made a Canon, which is a high-tech gadget that creates point particle in the bulk. But we have some crappy camera, which doesn't tell you that. You just like see this expanding shell. And there are many ways of getting expanding shells of energy that have nothing to do with point particles in the bulk. So it's really not a smoking gun. So what I will present now, I would improve the camera side of this measurement so that we can observe the bulk more finely and really see that we have a point particle in the bulk. So the question is like, what experiment would you do to be able to say that there was a point particle in the bulk, so that not just some like random shell all spread out? That's what we want to understand. The first design is probably the most intuitive one. So the two answers will involve four-point functions. And this four-point function is really a two-point function in the background of this excitation we've added on top of whatever background we have. So this four-point, what we can do with this thing is that we can use one of these O prime to create a pulse. So insert this at a point, it's going to create some pulse that moves speed of light into the bulk. And it's going to hit our excitation at some point P, and then can reflect, and then we can probe it from Y. Okay, this is literally a radar experiment, right? You show some pulse of light at something, and you record the reflection. It's just that the thing here now is this object O that we send into the bulk. The ideal regime of operation of this, the geometry is a bit tricky to visualize, and we'll come back to that later. But basically, this blue excitation here follows a null geodesic. I draw it double just to emphasize that this kind of two copies of O that's follow the same paths back and forth. And then the point Y here has to be in the future like cone of P, and Z in its past like cone. Okay. So there's like three null geodesics here. And the thing that we're looking for is that, so if I fix Z, and I fix this blue curve, that fixes P. And the thing that we're looking for is that there's going to be a sharp singularity as we approach the future like cone of P on the boundary. So X, Y, and Z are all points on the boundary, but there's a sharp singularity on some like cones that are very non-trivial functions of this geometry. So z and x define some, and p define some black cone. Find some point whose future light cone we're probing it. And in the ideal regime of operation of this gadget, of this camera, we want all of these particles, all of these waves to just follow geometrical optics. So we just have to think about three null geodesics. Mathematically, the description of this will be very similar to what was done in the so-called bulk point paper, where people studied four-point function, where you try to focus something to the bulk and try to have some scattering event near a bulk. So this reflection here is a bulk scattering event. But the only difference between what we do in this paper is the operator ordering. And because of the operator ordering, we don't have to track what happens to O in the future. This makes it much easier to probe a much bigger region in the bulk. So in the bulk point story, you basically have to be in global ADS and use the full cylinder. So you throw something in the past and then you like recover it in the future after it's rotated like 90 degrees on the cylinder. Here you can do this whole experiment in a small patch of the, basically if you want to probe a point P, you just need the causal wedge of P to do this experiment. A causal wedge that contains P is enough to do this experiment. So that's the basic experiment I want to be discussing today. So that it's all in this four-point function in a background state. And yeah, it's important here that the operator ordering is what it is, and it's important that Z is in the past of Y. So we can bounce something off. So it records the bounds. Any questions? Yeah, I will show pictures taken with this soon, so it will become less abstract. But I have a bunch of things to say before that. So if you're confused, feel free to interrupt. The geometry is not as okay. The second gadget I will present should make you puzzled. It doesn't exist on the mass market. I call it an active camera. It's something else you can do with four points, but now they're completely out of time order. So past, future. What does that do? So, okay, it's out of time order correlator. The idea we inject energy, a large energy in each pair. But we don't necessarily, in literature on chaos and so on, you may have heard about out of time order correlators in this context. People usually consider the late time behavior, and then you look at some exponential growth, which tell you about chaos somehow. Here, what we're after is very different. We're looking at early times, before scrambling, before all that. At times still large compared to the energies we put in. And what this correlator does is rather crazy. But okay, you could see it if you write down the, okay, what happened is that, I think it would really help if I could annotate. Let me see if I can do that. Let me try again. Sorry, I don't see how. Okay. Can you see my mouse at least?
Yeah, we can see the mouse.
Okay, yeah. So you have to imagine the Schwinger-Keldysh fourfold, where the points kind of alternate on it. So what happened is that the operator at Y, because of the way the fold go back in time, it creates an excitation that go backward in time. So the data is that we have a null geodesic that come from X in the future, go in the normal direction. And then we have its time reverse thing that come back from Y in the future. Okay. The signal we're after is that, so what can we play with? So what we can play with in this measurement is the shooting angles, which we control by the Fourier transform respect to small distances. So we have geodesics that are labeled by the boundary points and shooting angles. And the idea is that by tuning the shooting angles, we're going to get a peak when the impact parameter in the bulk is vanishes. So if we fix Px, there's going to be a peak in Py when there's a when we're at the right place. Okay, and this is meant to represent the past like cone of Y, the future like cone of X, and this curve here is like the boundary of the causal wedge. Okay, so we can play with all these parameters and try to get the singularity, try to get a good signal. So it's really like a camera, and you try to make it in focus. Play with the optics. And loosely speaking, it's really optics. Like, you can ask, if I do this Fourier transform here using a region of size L, remember size of L is the size of the Gaussian envelope. If I do the Fourier transform in the size of region L, then you can ask, what angular resolution am I going to have access to? And the answer is exactly like the way your eye works. Is like the angular resolution is the ratio of the wavelength that you're using to the size of the eye, which is this parameter. Okay, so that's the, and you can do actual calculation, it's really what comes out. So this is the angular resolution of the maximal possible angular resolution of this device is that, just from optics consideration. So if you work in a regime where you have good optics, then you can hope to get a sharp peak. We'll see that the dynamics is also important. There are theories where you never get a good peak, but we'll come to that later. So basically, what for this to work, you need good optics and you need the dynamics to be on your side also. But this measurement is, well, experimentally, I don't know anyone who can really measure 4 point out of time order correlators. But conceptually, it's very easy to interpret because we just have like two geodesics. Like you have one forward bound, one backward null geodesics, and you're just looking for when they intersect. But it's very, it's much easier to visualize than the radar we have. Just slides ago. So those are the two things we'll be considering with 4 point functions. So let me explain in what sense you want to reconstruct the bulk here. So the idea is that suppose we have some non-trivial bulk geometry here, maybe a black hole, something in the bulk. We want to image the geometry around it. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to send some particle, and we're going to image the path of this particle. Because by changing where the point y is, so if you fix y and you vary the angle py, you're basically taking a photo of where this particle is. Then if you take this photo for different y's, different times, then you're really making a movie of a particle moving the bulk. See? So reconstructing the metric from that information is a bit similar to how we find the gravity field of the sun by watching planets. It's the same class of problem. So the idea is to use this device to learn about the bulk. So I just want to contrast this with other way of like that people have discussed reconstructing a picture of the bulk. And probably the most basic one is to like, you don't need 4 point function. Like if you just have the 1 point function of stress tensor, in principle, you can just plug into Einstein equation, solve them radially and get a bulk metric. So in principle, you could do that. There's a version of that for called HKL for an arbitrary field using the equation of motion, basically. But in this case here, this is written for, if you have linear equation of motion for the field, you can imagine that the bulk equation of motion relate, can use, you can integrate the bulk equation of motion to express a bulk field in terms of boundary field in integrated over some region that, at minimally, you need some region that contains you need phi, you need the bulk point to be in the causal wedge of the region you're looking at. And there's various other ways that people have I've discussed to figure out the aspects of the bulk geometry, like entanglement entropy, give you areas of various extremal surfaces, and so on. I don't mean to say anything bad about this approach, but I just want to contrast it with what we're trying to do here. The idea is not so much to reconstruct the bulk, but it's really more to observe it. And explain the sharp difference here. And also, I don't just want to observe the bulk. I really want to observe locally what it means to have a... I really want to observe local features, to understand that the bulk really has gravity at small scales, not just at ADS scales. So local, I mean sub-ADS. And when you look at the statement of HKLL, for example, and they understood that already in 2006, so people often say that HKLL give an equivalence between the boundary Hilbert space and the bulk Hilbert space for small fluctuations. It's mathematically true, but in practice, it's a really Hill-Post problem, because when you look at the HKLL kernel, it is actually exponentially big at large momentum. It's exponentially hard to reconstruct local features using that kernel. And it's obvious why this has to be the case, because you can imagine, this was discussed later, you can imagine quantum states of a one particle in the bulk that basically describe a particle moving along the geodesic that never touched the boundary inside the causal wedge you're talking about. So the wave function of the particle has exponentially small overlap with the, give you an exponentially small signal inside that causal wedge. And because such one particle states exist, then any linear procedure which use data from the causal wedge to reconstruct the field inside has to have a huge exponential multiplying some repeatedly oscillatory function. We can still formally reconstruct it, but in practice, it's exponentially hard. And the same applies to Pfeffer-Mangram expansion and so on. You really need a huge accuracy on your boundary measurement to detect point-like excitations in the bulk. So it really only works well. It works best at large distances, but it has difficulty picking up small features. Another thing, which is a bit of a philosophical point, is that it's kind of fun, but for example, this applies especially to this approach, this Pfeffer-Mangram extension. You can apply it even though it makes no sense. Like you, for example, suppose you have a one-point function of stress tensor in the Ising model. An enthusiastic student could take that one-point function, plug into Einstein equation, and get some bulk metric. And then the student comes to you and say, "I got the metric of the 3D Ising model." And okay, nobody really believes that the Ising model is dual to Einstein gravity, but the thing which is a bit unsatisfactory with this procedure is that the student got absolutely no insight into whether the metric they got is physically relevant or not for the Ising model. You kind of have to decide that on some by trying to do other predictions, something else, but the procedure gives you no intuition about the significance of what you compute. So the main difference with the four-point function in this case, so a priori four-point function look much more complicated than 1 point and 2 points, but the point of using this higher point function is that we're looking at the signal which is never exponentially small. Like in this case, you have a point particle in the bulk, like the way we're going to probe it is much closer than how we actually observe like particle in the world. Like we're just going to like bounce some electromagnetic wave or something of it. Like we're going to observe things by normally we observe things by interacting with them, not by trying to sense their wave function at the long distance. So that's the spirit of what we're doing here. And the other thing which I like is that from these correlators, if someone could, let me go back a bit. So if someone could experimentally measure this thing, for example, or this radar thing here, they could immediately decide just from the data whether they can extract a metric or not, just because there's a metric only when they get a sharp singularity. And when there's sharp singularity, they can interpret and figure out what the trajectory of the particle is and what metric led to that. But with this method, you only reconstruct a metric when there is one. That is the main, to me, that's an important feature. So, yeah. So let's show how it, let's see how it works in examples. So now we just do examples in the geometrical optics approximations. The crudest approximations is going to be naive calculations that would justify later. But let's just see what it gives. Okay. So this is the first movie that you would have to do in your head. So here's the experiment. I'm fixing initial data. So I'm shooting from the origin in a straight into the bulk. And then at a fixed time delta t, I'm measuring the signal as a function of angle. I'm doing in ADS3 CFT2. So in the CFT2, there's like one, naturally one boost angle that you have. And in the ADS3, that maps to this one angle along this cone. So this is what this angle shows. So I'm showing the peak of the signal at some time delta t here. So you see the particle there was going, actually was going like to the left. So yeah. So this picture here, so you think of yourself on the boundary, you're looking into the bulk and you see a peak signal in that direction. So this happens when these geodesics hit each other. Basically, this signal comes from the, what would be like the 1/r potential in the bulk, integrated over time. And I took a derivative of this to make the signal sharper. But that comes just from the graviton exchange between these geodesics. That's what is plotted there. So before I proceed, I need you to predict what will happen when I press play. So suppose I increase the time delta t, and I take a look at this, ask, you know, where's the peak at a later time delta t?
I guess it would tilt up or things to intersect, but I don't know.
Yeah, can you say it again?
Okay, I don't know. I mean, I also looked at the paper, but I don't remember this part. It would tilt up like the, so that the, you're just trying to look at the angle at which the two geodesics intersect, right? Or
yes, yeah, yeah. And probably the figure is a bit misleading. I'm in vacuum. Yeah. I'm in vacuum, so this should be like straight lines in the cone.
Okay, sorry.
Okay. So this is like a straight line in the cone. Yeah. So as increased delta t, the cone in the bulk will get bigger. So the interaction will occur deeper in the bulk.
So then it intersects another.
Yeah. But how will the angle change? Yeah, everyone, try to visualize it. Anyone else want to say what will happen?
I think there are already three options and I already screwed up with two of them. So you're just gonna hit choice.
Yeah. So increase the time here and look at what's the peak angle for P, given that the angle at the origin is fixed. How does that peak angle evolve with time?
Would it change at all?
It doesn't, yeah. This is a fake play button, sorry. You got the whole movie. Okay. So in this experiment, absolutely nothing happens. I increase the time, but the peak angle doesn't change because I'm just rescaling the cone. Okay. Well, the intensity changed somewhat. We'll come to that. But the peak angle doesn't change at all. So that's what happens in vacuum. And the fact that the angle doesn't change, and actually some feature about the intensity, but the fact that the angle doesn't change basically is just the way that the experiment tells you that you have a scale invariant geometry. And if you apply this reconstruction to this geometry, you'll find it's ADS. We'll come to that. But yeah, that's how you would reconstruct the vacuum ADS geometry here, by realizing that this experiment is very boring. Okay. Now let me show a real one. Okay. Actually, without much effort, you can do the one for a thermal state in CFT2. It doesn't take a lot of effort because it's the correlator is a conformal transformation. So once you got a good approximation from geometric optics of this single, you can do a conformal transformation, replace some distance by sinh, and you get the signal in the bulk. Okay. Now we're going to add one bell and whistle to this experiment. Let me come back. So this angle here doesn't really tell you the depth. Like the cone got bigger, but we didn't see that. Now we need to add something to resolve depth. Come on, give me a way to resolve depth. What kind of measurement? What will you do? How do you resolve depth in a situation where we have like a camera or optics or anything?
Yeah. Luminosity flux. Sorry. No.
Yeah. That's one thing we use actually. Yeah, you just see how the luminosity changes. Yeah. Another way. Well, how do you see depth with your eyes? And when your eyes are
parallax,
not enough.
Technically.
Yeah, just
but so you're like going to change parallax. The width of the WIC packet. You're going to change the width of the WIC packet, right? Yeah.
You can change the width of the packet, or you can just like look from two different places.
Okay.
Just move your head a little bit and ask how the peak angle changes with the peak position. Okay. So we're going to draw the same picture here, but now there's going to be a signal from the left eye and from the right eye. So it's what happened when this bulk particle falls into a BTZ black hole. So at first, the particles start close to the horizon, and your eyes are really like, they're looking aside. So it's very hard to see both particles, to see the particle from both eyes at the same time. As the particle goes into the bulk, the angular distance between the two images reduces, like 1 over r. And eventually, what you observe, if you're in vacuum EDS, this distance will keep decreasing, like 1 over r, which goes like 1 over delta t. But what happens here, when there's a black hole in the bulk, is that it just you just see the distance freezes. In terms of, the horizontal axis here is like boundary time. So in terms of boundary time, the particle just stopped moving. It stopped going deeper into the bulk. So that's the first way that you see that there's a horizon, or at least something happening there. First thing, you observe a causal horizon. See it freezing. So you see that very straightforwardly from these images. And actually, I've done this calculation here on a finite radius circle. So past a certain time, light can go around the black hole. this is the side images. So this correlator really gives you that's the sort of images that this correlator literally is. Like, there's no data processing here. Like, this is just what the Fourier transform and the four-point function is. The other piece of information you get from this is the luminosity or intensity of the signal. What it looks like is that. So that's a plot. So at first it increases quadratically in delta t. And that, okay, it would be easier to understand if I could draw the Feynman diagram. It's because the bulk process we're looking at is graviton exchange in the bulk, and the graviton exchange amplitude is proportional to the center of mass energy in the bulk. So this is a blue shift factor. As we go, if we fix the boundary energy, as we increase the time, then the center of mass energy of the collision gets higher and higher in local units. So we get this blue shift factors. And this quadratic growth is a signature of having a scale invariant geometry. As we go to later times, at roughly the time where the radius hit the horizon, approach the horizon, you get this exponential growth, which is the famous Lyapunov exponent for the out of time order correlator of near black hole horizon. So this exponent is 2 pi t saturates the bound on chaos. So it's that story. So you see, so that's another signature. So this exponential growth is another signature of having a horizon. Maybe I should go back and stress. I was very surprised when I first saw this. It's very non-intuitive because I thought first that when you get close to the horizon, you get some big redshift factors and you see nothing. This is actually what you would get from like a radar camera. You get, if you try to bounce something, if you try to bounce a radar pulse of an object that's falling into a black hole, you get a Doppler redshift and you lose your signal. Instead, you get a blue shift. It's because this active camera, this out of time order correlator, is really not like an intuitive thing. Yeah. It's a very special thing to do.
Out of curiosity, could you have had like the camera be also incoming? I guess I don't know what's special about like the, if you're going to basically take the bulk point picture and fold the lines back over on themselves, like you could have like had X and Y both be like, I guess, forward shooting trajectories or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I think that would be some, that might be realized as some analytic continuation of the correlator. But I don't think you can do it in terms of time folds.
Okay.
Yeah, I tried to do it, but with time folds, they always like, the signal will always cancel out between the folds. But it could be that there's some mathematical analytic continuation which does that for you. Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. And here, the second curve here is the way you resolve depth here from this parallax measurements. Basically, it's like how much you have to move your head to get a fixed change in peak angle. This parallax is giving you directly a measure of, it's actually as dimension of length, it's giving you a measure of radius. Okay, you can see I've put the horizon at one. Yeah, it flattens when you hit the horizon. That's what we saw before. Okay. So this is basically what you get from raw data of this correlator. And the claim is that this data basically tells you the metric. And to extract the metric, you basically just have to make some ansatz and study geometrical optics. Just study what do null geodesics do in that metric. So here's the game, right? You make this ansatz here, so you have translation symmetry. So I have a metric that looks like this. And if you study null geodesics in depth, you'll find that the radius where you end up with, okay, there's a bunch of equations that I've skipped. But yeah, you can relate the single, E is the intensity of the signal, and Xi is a parallax. And these are two functions of time. And loosely speaking, the radius is correlated with time. And this formula gives you a precise formula for the radius function of time. So you have to take the derivative of the parallax respect to time, and then, yeah. But essentially, the claim is that they're taking derivative, yeah, it's a geometry problem. I think I cannot explain the solution in 2 minutes, but it's in the paper. The bottom line is that if you're given those two curves, all you have to do to figure out the bulk metric is to take some derivative of these curves. And literally, you get the data gives you a curve, actually two curves, one for this function a of r, b of r, that you can plot and turns out to be exactly the metric of that black hole. So the data is really simply related to the metric. And that is here, of course, from Einstein equation, A is equal to B, but I didn't put that at all. I put nothing about Einstein equation there. This just comes from looking at particles moving in that geometry. This is completely geometric measurement. And you get the bulk metric out. And so let me just say a general thing. So this type of measurement you can imagine doing in any CFTD and some state, in the thermal state. And yeah, this reconstruction is of course much easier when you have symmetries. Like it's like, you know, in astrophysics, like if you try to, it's a bit similar to trying to get the mass distribution of a galaxy from gravitational lensing. You know, it's not always easy, right? Not claiming it's easy. But yeah, you can do it.
Yeah. It's a little bit more to me, though, instead of like measuring something like astrophysically, it's like you almost more like in high school when you throw something and you record the picture of it. Like you're trying to measure something because you have control over the thing.
Yeah, you have much more control in astrophysics. Yeah, maybe easier than astrophysics because you can play with these shooting angles and all that.
I would say that the point is, yeah, is like normally you could say, like, I could use radar to, I want to know how fast somebody's speeding, but the point of here is that you're throwing something and so you have control over the,
yeah, you're like also the controlling over the geodesic
and you're measuring the yeah, like the sphere. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So this 4-point function has a lot of knobs. You have a lot of control over what you're seeing. So this just shows like there really is a lot of information in 4-point functions that you can interpret it that like this. And so we can do this in CFTD. And as I said, the metric is easily reconstructed from this derivative of this data, which means that, for example, Einstein equation can be written as some differential equation on the data that you measure in the field theory. And I think this is really striking. I don't know what these equations mean. It's just, Einstein equation in these very symmetrical states is like two first order equations. And there's all these equations. And I think it's very surprising that the bulk dynamics gives you a local differential equation on something that you can easily measure on the boundary. So I think it's very surprising, and then we need to understand better what these equations mean. But generally the picture I'm advocating is that if you want to study theories that may not be pure GR, but richer theories, or maybe, you know, where string corrections are important or things like that, instead of thinking about metrics, it might be a good idea to try to understand like what are the bootstrap constraints on this out of time order correlator. You know, at the first order, one would like to understand like, can one derive this equation from bootstrap of the 4-point OTOC? And that, I don't know how to do this, but that's a well-defined target.
Simon, can you hear me? I have a question. Hi.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Just out of curiosity, why are you surprised that the bulk Einstein equations are differential equations for boundary data? Isn't that essentially what the Fefferman-Graham construction tells you, that this boundary stress tensor or expectation value of the stress tensor is covariantly conserved? Is an Einstein equation in the bulk?
Yeah. The one of the Einstein equation is simple, but if you take an arbitrary state of there's much more to the bulk equation of motion than that statement. So this is telling. So in this example, okay, let's stick to this example of a thermal state. The 1-point function here is just a constant. Okay. Whereas this function, the parallax, a function of delta t, and the intensity is a function of delta t, they have much more information than the one-point function. They basically give us the metric.
I'm sorry, but I thought that it was a general theorem that if you give me the boundary metric and boundary stress tensor, I can reconstruct the bulk metric. I thought it was enough. Are you saying that that's not enough?
No,
you need
this
more
is,
information?
This is true. But I'm saying that I'm looking at a case where the one-point function is incredibly boring. And the way you will reconstruct Einstein equation is by using the bulk equation of motion, which has nothing to do with the boundary theory. Like the Pfefferman-Gran expansion is a bulk equation of motion.
Yes, but
it's a differential equation with respect to R, not with respect to delta T.
No. But the equation with respect to R is already solved in Pfefferman-Gram, right? I'm telling you about the constraint. So the constraint equation in Pfefferman-Gram tells you that the boundary stress tensor is covariantly conserved. And if you know the boundary stress tensor and this constant, that means that you have constant temperature. And the dual solution in the bulk to constant temperature state in the boundary is a black hole solution. So I don't understand why you are saying that these equations are surprising. I'm just asking a simple question.
Let me tell you what this equation are about. This equation are not about the one-point function of stress tensor. So maybe a good analog would be like, think about a two-point function of a heavy field in this geometry, okay? This two-point function are usually approximated in terms of geodesic length, okay? Suppose you're given this data. You have geodesic length, the length of a bulk geodesic as a function of the boundary separation.
Okay.
The question is, what do Einstein equation imply on this function? And the answer to that question is nothing nice, because the geodesic length is a very non-local integral over the bulk metric.
Okay, can I rephrase the problem maybe in a way where so say you do what Luca wants to do, or whatever people do this bulk of construction, you give me the boundary, I do Pfefferman-Gram or whatever, go into the bulk. So now I have the metric in the bulk from this one-point function. And now what I want to do is I want to, I guess, solve for the geodesics on that background. And then I look for how the initial conditions for my geodesics like vary, because I could take the answer from the one-point function and try to compute the classical version of what you're doing now, right? And I guess the question is like, how much harder is that than just strictly speaking, starting from what you're starting from, or what do you miss maybe if you're trying to just say like, right. Because that procedure should effectively be able to, do the computation you want to do, which is to track back the, like how varying the initial conditions for my geodesic affect, like, I guess how the future geodesic is going to like.
Let me explain why I don't want to use Pfefferman-Gram, because I kind of said that at the beginning, and let me say it again. Mm-hmm. So first of all, it only works if you have pure Einstein equation in the bulk.
Sure.
My interest is to study strongly coupled field theory, where I don't a priori know where the bulk is.
But I'm saying you could try to classically look at the same quantities, right, that you're looking at here. It's just it wouldn't be interesting.
And the other thing I will say is that imagine you had a not empty ADS, but suppose you had some small amount, some amount of matter somewhere that's localized matter. So you have a black hole plus some little matter outside, a little bit of matter outside. Detecting this, in principle, Pfefferman-Gram will detect this bit of matter, but you require exponential accuracy on the one-point function of a stress tensor. Whereas this type of measurement here, you just see when you pass next to this particle, you just see that there's like bending. So it may not be like a profound philosophical difference, but to me it's a difference between having an exponentially small signal versus an older one signal. Okay? So that's the difference between that's the difference between these sort of measurements. Okay, so that's why I don't want to use one-point functions. I'm trying to use only these higher point functions. But normally, if you try to use higher point functions, you'd have this problem that the data, like the initial condition, the geodesic, and so on, are related to the bulk metric in a very non-local way. That's why it's surprising that you get simple local equations on this higher point correlators. Okay. That answer your question?
I have another question.
Yeah.
On the note of going away from pure GR, I was wondering, so if the bulk has also, in addition to ADS, some compact directions, do you think it's possible? Is there any way that some variation of this prescription could tell you about these compact directions?
Yeah. One thing I can say is that in vacuum, we understand that if you take the correlation function of four stress tensors, you're basically measuring a graviton scattering amplitude in the bulk, which knows about these contact interactions. And in the past year, we've used this trick in vacuum to bootstrap and constrain modifications to Einstein equations. So you're asking me roughly, do I hope that we can do the same in the general background? That's my dream. I've not done it, but that the hope is that what we could do in vacuum will extend to the general background. That would get some, be able to see that there are small corrections, but the small corrections would be related to the existence of heavy fields in the bulk. But that at the moment we have not done anything in this direction. So let me explain we'll skip this slide. Let me explain briefly on something about the correction to this geometric optics picture. I'll go a bit into this direction of having stringy effects. Okay. The slide is meant to explain why there's a shortcut to do the calculation. It was very, the paper could be very lazy because they don't have to do a new calculation. So it turns out that this out of time order correlator is essentially what we're interested in on the right. But it turns out it was already calculated 15 years ago because it's the same as the rigid limit of four point function in vacuum at least. And the relation comes as follows. So the rigid limit of a four point correlation function in vacuum, so imagine you have a theory in the cylinder. So I'm drawing it like a 2D cylinder. So I have this one space direction that's periodically identified. So that's a Poincaré patch. I'll point space-like from infinity. And the rigid limit is when you apply a large boost to, well, you apply a large relative boost to two operators compared to other ones. So you have points that approach null infinity. And the feature is that this point here, one, becomes null separated from this point two. And actually any geodesic from one, they're like antipodal points. So any geodesic from one in the cylinder ends up at the point two. So that's the rigid limit. And you can think of it as high energy scattering at this middle. The thing that, so that's been well studied. But the claim is that this measurement here makes sense on the cylinder. You don't have to draw a Poincaré patch around it. Or put differently, you could like slide the Poincaré patch around and talk about the exact same correlator and interpret it differently. So if I slide the four points northeast by half a Poincaré patch, I get a picture in the middle, and there's a fact that there's a neat fact that was explained in detail later, is that going outside the Poincaré patch is exactly the same as folding the picture and going to a second time fold. So this corridor on the left is exactly the same as the corridor on the middle. I've just translated it on the cylinder, which does nothing. But now it has a different interpretation because I have measurements 3 and 4 that are doing at future infinity. Measurement done at infinity is at what we call recently taken to call detectors. And now we have an object created at point one, and going back the complex conjugate matrix element and the bra at point 2. That's an expectation value of 3 and 4 in a state 1. And then you can play the same game and fold again the picture. So if I take this picture and I translate it southwest by half a patch, I get an extra fold that is the thing on the right, which is the out of time order correlator. So that this picture explains why in vacuum, when you have all the symmetry of the cylinder, the rigid limit of correlator is exactly the same thing as this out of time order correlator.
Can I ask one question there?
Yes.
So I guess if I wanted to try to make that make sense without going into detail for the Kravchuk and Simazeffin's paper, I guess what I would try to do is imagine that instead of actually unwinding the time direction in my Einstein cylinder, I literally just have like the time circle, and now I have basically the Poincaré patch is half of it. And so that folding is kind of like going around this periodicity and the time direction. Is that something you like? You're like, yeah. Ah, or, yeah.
You might be able to do it, but I was never able to make that precise because the folding is really done along this cone. It's not along a fixed time slice on the cylinder.
I have the, say I really do have a periodic time direction. I could just move what I want to consider my Poincaré patch around, probably.
Yes.
To,
yeah.
Yeah. And then it would kind of be a fold because I'm always looking at what is my Z2 identification on that cylinder, right? I'm sorry, on that, I guess, whatever, kind of like that time. Yeah.
Yeah, it might. So, I'm still not sure. I have the feeling that if you try to look at a cylinder with a periodic time, you'll be looking at really at a different theory, because here with all of this is taken in the vacuum on the cylinder. But if you have a periodic time, but if it was a periodic Euclidean time, you would be looking at thermal state on the cylinder. So I think it's a different observable. I think it's important that the cylinder extends to infinity to project into the vacuum.
Because there's a part of me that kind of wants to think if I view the S matrix as like just I prepare some initial state on the in part of the Poincaré patch, and then I look at outside and the outside, that kind of like S dagger S equals one is the periodicity in that time circle direction. But
we can talk again. So let me, I'm about to finish. Let me just briefly explain how we use this. So roughly speaking, the formulas from conformal rigid theory that people obtain for the rigid limit have the following flavor. So there's some kinematical factors, like this Lejeune polynomial here. There's some dependence on energy. So rigid limit is cross ratio going to zero. And as you go to this limit, you get some enhancement. There's the blue shift factors for graviton exchange that I mentioned. And nu here is an interpretation of, it's basically a momentum in ADS, transverse momentum. And alpha is basically the bulk scattering. It's proportional to a bulk scattering amplitude in the rigid limit. So here, this pole here represents graviton exchange. And the crucial fact, which is that this thing decays exponentially. So actually you can take this representation and do the Fourier transform that against wave packets that we started with, and it all commutes. And you get the following formula for the correlator. And now the integrand becomes literally the flat space scattering amplitude. So you can see from this sort of formalism that you're really just measuring a flat space amplitude in the limit that we have high energies, it's in the forward scattering amplitude in the boundary, so large energy compared to the momentum transfer. It's dressed by some Gaussian that suppresses large momentum that comes from the size of wave packet you're using. It's Gaussian just because we use Gaussian wave packets. And the Fourier transform of position space Gaussian is a Fourier space Gaussian. So essentially, what we see is the Fourier transform, the amplitude. And that makes it very easy to add stringy effects. So we can plot this correlator at various couplings and then course four spring angles and see what it looks like. So you send in the point particle in the bulk, at least you do your best to send in the point particle, and you try to see if you get a sharply peaked image. And what you get is this. So let's look on the left column here. So in the weakly coupled theory, so G is the coupling from integrability. The reduced convergence is like 0.25 of perturbation theory. So at weak coupling, you don't see sharp peaks. You try your best to send a particle straight into different direction along the circle, or different directions you can look into the bulk or shoot into the bulk. So you try to shoot something straight into ADS, and you record it, get a signal looking anywhere. So there is no local bulk physics at weak coupling. And you can try to increase your optics, and it doesn't help. Yeah. As you increase the coupling, it gets a bit better. Of course, on the top row, if you use poor optics, you use wave packets that are very fat and that have a very large spread in momentum, they're not focused very well. You also don't see anything. So to really see the bulk using this device, you need good optics, and you also need a theory that is strongly interacting. Okay. And then for G equal 100, you get something like this. Typically, people say that string theory, where the strong coupling expansion works very well when G is order 10. So okay, you can kind of start seeing that this is a point particle. But the limitation effectively is set by the string scale. So I will explain a bit how to think about this limitation. So the useful concept is this rigid trajectories that were explained by in this famous paper of 2006. On the horizontal axis, the scaling dimension of local operators, which is an entity continuum to give you the momentum in ADS. On the vertical axis, you have the spin, and the spin of a particle you exchange is conjugate to the energy dependence of the amplitude for exchanging that particle. And what happens at strong coupling is that this trajectory becomes very flat. It has to become very flat because it has to pass through local operators, and the first higher spin operator at spin 4 is very far out on the right. So the curvature is suppressed by the higher spin, by the gap in the spectrum of higher spin, by the scaling dimension of the first spin 4 single trace. So at strong coupling, the curvature is very small, and that's what enables you to use very large momenta. You can use momenta up to the string scale. And therefore, you probe the bulk up to string length. Yeah. But at weak coupling, this plot is highly curved. And if you try to use large momenta, you realize that you can't. So weakly coupled theory, because it doesn't have these flat rigid trajectories, doesn't enable you to make focused image on the bulk. You cannot resolve sub-LDS lengths. That's a very generic feature. So this plot is really making clear the connection between being able to see point-like excitation in the bulk and having a large higher spin gap in your spectrum. And here's one more plot. You can play this game in the 3D Ising model. And yeah, the rigid trajectories are really steep. They're basically at 45 degrees, and then this is an estimate of what it could be. See, this is in the Wilson-Fisher theory, somewhere between, I think it's in 3.5 dimension. But anyway, they're very steep, even in 3D. And because they're very steep, there's no way to use large momenta. And, well, if you see a point particle on the right, I think you should get your eyes corrected. There really is no hint of point-like bulk excitations in that theory. So I'm going to finish here. I wanted to say a few things about Bootstrap, but I will skip that. Yeah. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Simone. Any questions before I bother him for a while and other stuff? Okay, I guess all the questions are asked during the talk.
Sorry, can I ask some questions?
Maybe
I missed your points. So where did you need to use the Icona approximations, and why would you need it? Like when I was looking at your paper.
It's to connect. It's kind of built into this actually, into this conformality theory. But the point is that this picture here, mm-hmm. like to calculate this 4-point function exactly is very hard, because you have to mm-hmm. use bulk to boundary propagator and then some bulk Witten diagram. It would be very hard to calculate exactly, and it's also very mm-hmm. hard to interpret the result. The Icona approximation basically gives you the same as geometric optics. It tells you that this particle is going to follow a null geodesic, and then the interaction is going to be supported on this null geodesic. So when the Icona approximation is valid, this correlator is A, much easier to compute, and B, mm-hmm. much easier to interpret.
I see. Thanks.
Otherwise, you're doing a complicated, messy experiment with the result you have no way of making sense of.
If you go away from the Icona approximation, yeah. you don't really have any interpretation of the bulk.
Yeah. You don't get anything. The sort of thing you would see is that you could still do this experiment, but now instead of getting a sharp peak when y is in the future like cone of p of some point p, you'll just get some big fat peak. And then a bit like the last plots I showed that are very like delocalized. And they would give you no hint that there was a bulk point P in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So the Icona approximation buys you sharp features on the boundary.
I see. Thank you.
Can I ask some related question?
Yes.
So is there any criterion where given CFT, so some putative bulk gravity, is the Icona approximation valid? Do you know, like, do you have any, or is this like assumption? Like that?
What's the criterion from the field theory viewpoint? Yeah, this is what I was trying to explain here. So a necessary criterion for Icona approximation to make sense is that the leading rigid trajectory should be very flat.
Okay.
This requires a higher spin gap. This is a necessary condition. Without this, you cannot access large momentum. And if you cannot access large momentum, you cannot localize to a Lie ring. So that's a necessary condition. Now, of course, there may be situations, maybe the bulk has some lot of excitations and ripples that are high frequencies. Like there are a lot of ways that geometrical optics can break down. So this is only a necessary condition. So you need you need the theory to be nice, but you also need to be in a state that has a nice holographic dual.
So it's my ignorance, but does Ising CFT also follow this condition?
Yeah, exactly. Ising CFT does not have a flat leading trajectory.
Okay.
And if you try to see whether the image looked like what you would get from the Icona approximation, the answer is no. In the Icona approximation, you get like a sharp point. But the image you actually get from this 4-point correlator in the Ising model is just this fat blob. So Ising model does not have local physics in that sense.
It's interesting because in the pure boundary QFT point of view, I think the current state of art is that this Icona-like approximation, this is like a dual to some scramble approximation.
Mm-hmm.
So roughly speaking, you can compute the Ortog in the boundary QFT.
Yeah.
In terms of almost like a tree-level approximation.
In Ising model?
No. Not every QFT, but this is like the necessary condition is like a large N or semi-classical approximation.
Exactly. But what you find in actually Ising model, this we discussed so in the detector paper in the fall, and it's discussed in this paper. What you find from this OTOP is that like typically you would like to see it grow, like the Lyapunov exponent is positive.
Yeah.
And what you actually find in Ising is that the leading Lyapunov exponent is negative.
So, sorry, could you, my AirPod was disconnected.
What you actually find in 3D Ising is a negative Lyapunov exponent. So this is at zero temperature, but when you go to high energies. So if you send
yes. But that's pretty okay. But I would say that's in the perspective of pure like under QFT, because usually this Lyapunov exponent or exponential behavior is only well defined if you have a large and if you have a finite number of degree of freedom.
But it's also well defined when it's negative. Because then the correlator approach identity asymptotically.
Okay. So it's negative. Okay. For
I agree with you that if the exponent is positive, then this growth can only be a transient, and you can only define the exponent if the coefficient is small, like a large n expansion. But in Wilson-Fincher theory, it's actually better defined because the leading exponent is negative, so the correlators become closer and closer to a free theory as you go to high energies.
Okay, thanks. And then is there also generic restriction which kind of correlator you should detect? Because like there are huge difference between for Otogo stress tensor or conserved quantities or some random.
Ah, that's a good question. Correlator. Yeah. So in the first approximation, they're all the same. In the geometrical optics regime, they're all the same. And they all interact by exchanging gravitons.
Yes.
On the other end, this is one of the things I mentioned in the conclusion. If you wanted to measure not the bulk geometry, but some other bulk field, then presumably at subleading order, other correlators will give you more information than so the fact that you can use very various different correlators will give you information. So at the first order, they all look the same. They are controlled by null geodesics and graviton exchange. Gravity is universal.
Okay. I see. It's a bit surprising because like stress tensor doesn't grow exponentially, for example.
Not the local.
Even in chaotic system. Even in chaotic system, yeah.
Ah, I see what you mean, yeah. This in this high energy regime here, the local energy density does have the same growth as anything else. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. Thank you. A lot of good questions.
Any further questions?
At what point did you use large N here?
Ah, okay. Yeah, it was also hidden a bit, but sorry. Focus on the string scale, but to ever make this plot, you need large N. So basically, string EFX prevents you from having transverse momentum that are larger than the Planck scale, than the string scale. But also, you don't want to use energies that are higher than the Planck mass. It's important. If you put too much energy into your correlator, such as center of mass energy at the bulk interaction point exceeds the Planck scale, then you will kind of lose your signal. You will form black holes and stuff in the bulk. You will that's called scrambling. You basically lose the signal you're after.
I see.
So we need large N and we need the large gap.
I see. Uh-huh.
More questions? If not, let's thank Simone again.